Today on Wings, clean water and sanitation are now our human right.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Maud Barlow is a Canadian best known around the world for writing about the science and politics of the world's water. But she has also done much work on women's issues and co-founded the social action organization Council of Canadians. Maud Barlow addressed the Denman Island Readers and Writers Festival on July 19, 2014.
I came out of the women's movement, very much involved in the human rights, women's rights, minority rights, and so on. I've been the director of the Office of Equal Opportunity for Women for the City of Ottawa. I've been a senior advisor to Pierre Trudeau on women's issues. I was introduced once as his senior advisor on women's affairs. And I said, actually, he looks after those all by himself. And then I looked down, and there was a Globe and Mail reporter, and I said, please don't report that. So my journey came through the women's movement and got involved in setting up the Council of Canadians, which is about to turn 30. I cannot believe it. When we were concerned about the Canada-US Free Trade Agreement being signed by Brian Mulroney and Ronald Reagan, and the concerns we had then about what this would do to Canadian social programs, from my perspective, it was around, again, these social security issues. And our energy, which we did lose total control of, by the way, and water and many other things. So we founded the council, and we lost that trade agreement fight because even though the majority of Canadians didn't want it, the no vote divided between the NDP and the Liberals, and so the rest is history kind of thing. So I started monitoring and just collecting data on what was happening, huge job losses as the American manufacturing companies no longer had to site here, to sell here, right? So. And I kept saying to people, somebody should write a book on this. I've got so much material for them. I've even got a great title. It's from the parcel, it's called Parcel of Rogues, from a Rabbi Burns poem about the parcel of rogues in Scotland who sold out Scotland. And the line goes, British steel we could disdain, but British gold has been our bane. What a parcel of rogues in a nation. And the rogues were the Scottish elite who sold the country out. So I said, I've even got the title. And finally, my friend said, Maud, get off the pot and do it yourself. I wrote a book called Parcel of Rogues and then have not stopped doing it since. So anybody out there who's an aspiring writer, let me tell you, you don't have to see yourself as a writer. You got something in your head and your heart you want to tell. You start telling it. Just start writing it down. I'm living proof that this can be true. So how did I get involved in water? Well, there were two strains in the water issue. One was the strain of coming out of the women's movement because water is still a women's issue in the global south. It is the women who have to walk for kilometers to get water. It is the girl children who can't go to school because they have to go with their moms. And also, if there's no facilities at the school, the girls are frightened to go to school because of sexual assault, because they have to go to the bathroom out in the fields behind the school or whatever. So this is really, I mean, it's an everybody issue, but it really does affect women in a very profound way. And the other way I came at it was way back looking at that Canada-US Free Trade Agreement and then NAFTA after that. And then every other bilateral trade and investment agreement, all of them consider water a tradable good. And I thought, what does that possibly mean? I can see oil and gas being tradable goods, but water is a human right. Water is an essential service. How could water be a tradable good? So that started me on a journey asking about who has access to water. And that was happening at a time in the 1990s when we were first beginning to understand that we're a planet running out of clean water, which is something we all learned in grade 6 wasn't possible. But I assure you, we are a planet destroying the finite water sources that we have at an alarming rate through over-extraction of our groundwater, through damming of our rivers for a global food chain, for hydroelectricity, for all the wrong kinds of energy. And I don't have time to go into many stats here, but we'll just tell you one global study that says by 2030, demand for water in our world will outstrip supply by 40%. So we are a planet in crisis. And I know with climate change, and you know that that means some places there'll be more water when we don't want it, i.e. flooding. But the California story, the story in China, the story in India, these are the stories now that are calling out to us, because as we move to a planet with potentially 9 to 10 billion people and a dramatically declining water source, the issue of the human right for water is going to come forward. So I wrote a report for an organization I belong to in the U.S. called the International Forum on Globalization, and it was on it was basically on the question, the political question about who owns water. It was called Blue Gold, the world water crisis and the commodification of the world's water. And that morphed into the first water book I wrote called Blue Gold, which morphed into the second water book, which is called Blue Covenant. And Blue Covenant basically was about the fight for the human right to water. And then this book tells the story as we need to go forward and basing the future on principles. And I say that we need to declare water as a human right. We need to recognize it, that it's a public trust and a common heritage and mustn't be allowed to be appropriated for private property. I say that water has rights too, which means that we have to not just see the right to water, but the right of water, and have to protect and rebuild water systems. And that, by the way, which is one of the major antidotes to climate change, because climate change isn't just about greenhouse gas emissions, it's also about the desertification through the destruction of watersheds in local regional areas, so the local hydrologic cycle is interrupted. And then the fourth principle is that water can teach us how to live together. And I argue that just as it's potentially possible for water to be a source of conflict, which it already is, it's being used as a weapon of war in Syria right now, for instance, just as it's potentially a conflict-inducing, violence-inducing, war-inducing reality, it could also be nature's gift to teach us how to live together better with one another and more lightly on our Earth. So those are the principles I put forward here. But thinking about what I wanted to read to you, because I don't usually read, I thought, well, I'll tell you a little bit about the story of the fight for the human right to water, because that's been a big one. People say to me, well, human right, of course water's a human right. Are you crazy? What are you talking about? It's just the most fundamental thing. And I can tell you the fight took 15 years at the United Nations. Water was not included in the UN Declaration on Human Rights in 1948, because nobody then could conceivably think of water as a problem. So it wasn't that they rejected it, it wasn't on the table. But as the last few decades have made it very clear that there are many, many, many people suffering from lack of water, well, more children die of waterborne disease every day than all forms of violence, including war, put together. So it became very, very clear that we're dealing with a global crisis that's not getting better. In fact, it's getting worse because of the decline in water stock. So you put the double whammy of increased population, increased demand, decreased supplies, and the water prices going up everywhere, often as a result of privatization. You've got a perfect storm for the cutoff of water to millions and millions more people every decade. So this became an obsession with me, and I started a group around the world called Friends of the Right to Water. We pulled in organizations and community groups from around the world to start to make this move. And we had fierce resistance. Our fierce resistance came from big water companies. The World Bank was totally opposed because they were promoting a privatization agenda on water services in the global south. Countries like Canada, and recently Canada, when we had the fight, Canada led the campaign against the human right to water. I was just, how can you believe that? It's true. And many, many forces that just didn't want an expansion of the notion of human rights. But it was something that we were not able to let go. And I had the great honor, which I'm going to read to you, I could tell you, but I'm supposed to read. So I'm going to read this, how I got inside, right deep inside the United Nations in an incredible situation. So I said, I've been deeply involved with the global water justice movement, attending every World Water Forum and helping to create the alternative forum process. In 2008, I was given the honor of serving as senior advisor on water to Miguel Descoto Brockman, the newly elected 63rd president of the UN General Assembly. President Brockman, or Father Miguel as he prefers to be called, is a Nicaraguan priest by training with a long history of deep commitment to social justice issues. On taking office, he publicly declared his concern about the impact of the global water crisis on the poor and pledged his support for a General Assembly resolution recognizing the human right to water and sanitation. Without his direction and support, I doubt that we would have been successful. President Descoto Brockman contacted me just before he took the office and invited me to advise him and guide the process toward a General Assembly resolution. I said, "You bet." I didn't put that here, but that's what I said to him. I said, "You bet." And it was a volunteer position. In fact, they were so broke in his office that my organization ended up paying my airfare and hotel while I stayed. So believe me, it wasn't a gravy train. It was ironic in a way that I should be chosen for this task, as it was the Canadian government under Prime Minister Stephen Harper that led the opposition to any formal recognition of the right to water at the United Nations. When I spoke at committees and panels, the Canadian representatives at the UN generally got up and left. Really awful, like really obviously, up as a group and walk out. So I go on to talk about getting deeply immersed in the inner workings and having the access to this information and what I was told by all of the agencies working on water at the United Nations, that there's nowhere to send this up to. There's no body, like unlike other issues such as climate change, environmental issues or human rights issues, there was nobody to receive this information. So they would collect this terrific information and have nowhere for it to go. So no country was stronger in its support than Bolivia and its president, Evo Morales. Bolivia was one of 20 countries that challenged the ministerial statement of the 2009 Istanbul World Water Forum because of its refusal to recognize the right to water. This is a forum that takes place every 3 years, and every single time they reject the notion of the human right to water. Bolivia's ambassador to the UN was Pablo Solo, a passionate human rights advocate and son of the famous Latin American muralist Walter Solo Romero, who depicted his people's suffering in his powerful art. If you ever have a chance to Google Walter Solo Romero, they're hard to look at because they're real depictions of terrible suffering of Latin Americans, particularly Bolivians. I had worked with Pablo before he was ambassador to the UN, and on one of my many trips to Bolivia, he introduced me to the newly elected President Morales. I put my case to him that Bolivia should lead the crusade to the UN for the right to water, and Evo Morales gave me his word that he would. In June 2010, Ambassador Solon presented to the General Assembly a draft resolution on the human rights to water and sanitation to intense criticism. Many member states fought the process, arguing that the world was not ready for such a step. Some countries counseled waiting for more research. Others tried to get Solon to weaken the clear language of the resolution and drop the reference to sanitation. Solon refused, rightly citing that lack of sanitation is a leading cause of death and must be included. Others demand that he add the words access to water and sanitation, but again, Solon refused, noting that changing the words to include access would let states off the hook, allowing them to argue that private companies were offering these services and therefore their obligations had been met. Pablo Solon wouldn't budge. He declared that he would rather have the resolution defeated than diluted, and he would like to see which countries would stand up in the General Assembly Hall of the United Nations and vote against the human right to clean water and life-saving sanitation. While the debate raged on, I and my staff moved to New York for the 2 months before the vote in order to work for its ratification, and our allies were lobbying individual member states to gain the needed votes. On July 28, 2010, nearly 2 months later and after much wrangling, 39 countries, mostly from the Global South, presented the final resolution to the General Assembly. It said, "The General Assembly recognizes the right to safe and clean drinking water and sanitation as a human right that is essential for the full enjoyment of life and all human rights." And it called upon all member states and international organizations to assist developing countries to provide safe, clean, accessible, and affordable drinking water and sanitation for all. And it also said they had to appoint a rapporteur, a special rapporteur, which has happened. She's wonderful. 122 countries, including China, Russia, Germany, France, Spain, and Brazil, supported the resolution. I was up in the balcony with my staff, and I thought we were going to lose. I was holding their hands, saying, don't worry, we'll be back. Just to be here now is so important, because they were in tears, and we were sure, bang, up on this electronic board, because they all vote from where they're sitting, 122 countries vote in favor. And many of those that abstained said they would revisit their opposition if the Human Rights Council were to weigh in, which it did 2 months later with a similar resolution. Support of the resolution received that day demonstrated that the world was finally moving to address the issue. The countries that voted in favor represent 5.4 billion people. Those that abstained represented 1.1 billion. Countries that opposed the resolution did not actually vote against it, including Canada. Rather, they abstained. This was the best signal yet that the debate over this fundamental right was finally winding down. Despite this, the abstaining countries made a number of angry speeches after the vote, accusing Bolivia of forcing a vote that no one was ready for. Pablo Solon was in the, he was up in the balcony with me, stood with his arms folded across his chest and a small smile on his face, letting the bitterness pass by him like so much air. It was like he was saying, what part of I just won and you didn't do you not get, right?
On Wings, this is Maud Barlow speaking in July 2014.
So what did that mean? Well, it did not mean that the next day everybody in the world had access to clean water, but it did mean that as a human species, we'd taken an evolutionary step forward. It was a huge, huge move. And the Human Rights Council did come out and clarify what it meant, and they had a similar resolution, and then it every country in the world, Canada being the last, finally adopted it at Rio Plus 20. Canada was the last country in the world to adopt this, and still has no plan, by the way. They're all supposed to have a plan. No plan for drinking water in First Nations communities, which is where it's, of course, needed in this country. But we have succeeded in getting a number of constitutions changed. We have used it in so many ways. I'm going to just tell you two stories about how we have used the human right to water successfully. For several years, the government of Botswana had been forcibly and violently evicting the Kalahari Bushmen from their traditional lands in the Central Kalahari Game Reserve. But the Bushmen kept returning to the desert, unable to live well outside their ancestral homeland. The young people were committing suicide, there was drugs and alcohol, it was really quite terrible. In 2002, in a particularly vicious move, the government smashed their only major water borehole to secure the eviction of those who remained. Diamonds had been discovered on their lands, and the government handed over priority land and water access to the mining companies and ecotourism operators. In his book, Heart of Dryness, American journalist James Workman wrote about his time among the Kalahari Bushmen and the suffering they endured, living in a desert without water and in constant fear of the security forces that were terrorizing them. Workman recounted the haunting story of Hurlukso, a Bushman elder, and her, she's a woman, and her small band. The authorities arrived in trucks carrying big guns to destroy their remaining water canteens and spill their water barrels. Despite this, the people would still not leave their land. As the thirsty months passed, water had to be scrounged from dew and wild melons. Anyone caught trying to smuggle water into the desert was arrested and imprisoned. Hunting was outlawed as well. The plan was to deprive the people of any form of water or sustenance so that they would leave. But Gurlukso stayed and looked after her band, giving all the water she could and all the water that was allocated to herself to the young. One hot day in 2005, her family found her dead under a tree. An autopsy revealed that Kurlukso had almost no fluid in her body and that her heart was completely dried up. It was black. When they took her heart out, it crumbled in their hands. It was absolutely like burnt wood. She had sacrificed her own water needs for years so that others might live, and she died of dehydration. Those were the stakes when the Bushmen, working with Survival International, took their government to court. In 2006, now this is before the human rights resolution, right, they won an important victory that allowed them to return to their ancestral homeland. But in that decision, they did not win back the right to their water sources, so the Bushmen appealed to gain access to their broken borehole. 1 week before the UN General Assembly voted to recognize the human right to water and sanitation, a high court judgment again denied the Bushmen their water rights. But then, 1 week later, we had this resolution, so they came back. They did not give up. Then a momentous decision came down from the Court of Appeal in January 2011, citing the UN's new recognition of the rights to water and sanitation. The court unanimously quashed the earlier ruling and found that the Bushmen did have the right to use their old borehole as well as the right to sink new boreholes. The ruling judges called the treatment of the Bushmen by the government degrading. In its judgment, the court said it was entitled to have regard to international consensus on the importance of access to water and referenced the two general resolutions. Roy Sasana, a Bushman leader, received the Right Livelihood Award the year I did in 2005. On the day the borehole was reopened, he stood beside it along with his community and said, "We are very happy that our rights have finally been recognized. We have been waiting a long time for this. Like any human beings, we need water to live." This is one of our beautiful success stories, although to every success story, you know you have to keep fighting because now they're fracking in the Kalahari. So our fracking fight, we're very involved in the anti-fracking movement here in Canada, and our fracking fight has gone international. We have an international frack down day, and so we call ourselves fractivists and so on. So now we're working with him. So that's one story I wanted to tell you. The other, you probably read about Detroit, Michigan. Detroit, Michigan has been declared bankrupt, as if a city can go bankrupt, as if it were a corporation. But the very right-wing governor of Michigan has just declared a few months ago that it's bankrupt. And so they appointed an emergency manager, and his sole responsibility is to get the debt down. So he's pulling pensions back from firefighters and police officers and health workers and so on. They're talking about selling off major pieces of art. They have one of the most important art collections in the world. It's just there used to be a lot of money there and a lot of people who are really concerned and loved culture and art and so on. And they're planning to sell the water services department, water and sanitation department. Now, here's what happened in Detroit over the years, and I would argue that this is a lasting legacy of three decades of neoliberal policies that are totally designed to support and enrich the 1% in our world. I mean, I think that's the story of what we've done. Deregulation, privatization, unregulated free trade agreements, investor state rights that give corporations the right to come in and take over local domestic law and basically challenge any law that they can say interferes with their right to profit. This is how they lock in this privatized world that really does enrich a small group of people and puts the rest at risk. In fact, in our country, we used to look like a big egg with a small group of wealthy and a fairly small group of poor and lots of us in the middle. Now we look more like a pear with fewer and fewer of us at the top and more of us falling out at the bottom and one paycheck or one welfare social security check away from poverty, right? Getting bad here, but it's more extreme in other places, and it's really extreme in the United States. So what happened with Detroit was when they went globalized and the auto industry collapsed and moved to Mexico and other places, they had to have what they call white flight. The money left. The 1%ers, the 50%ers, the top 50%ers moved out. Almost 1 million people left Detroit. They went to wealthy suburbs like Oakland County, and they left behind a city 80% African American, poor, without the tax base anymore because all that money left, so no tax base to pay for essential services. And so they started jacking up the prices of electricity, hydro, and water and so on. The water rates went up 130% in just under 10 years. So for the poorest people in the country, just about, the water rates became absolutely astronomical. Plus, there was huge corruption in the water department, which has been exposed. They stopped sending out bills to people as a cost-cutting measure, and then they put in these smart meters into homes that read backwards, so you were given a bill of $8,000 that went back to people who lived there before you. Unbelievable. Didn't fix the water systems. You go through downtown Detroit in the winter on a cold snap, you'll hear water running everywhere because the pipes are in just terrible condition, and sometimes you'll get a bill for a pipe that's running just outside your door, and that water that is not coming into your home is billed to you. Well, one of the things that this manager decided to do was sell off the water and sewage department. So in order to make this more appealable to water companies, and the two big ones are Veolia and Suez from France, and you can bet your bottom dollar they're in there because a major water system on the Great Lakes of North America owning that, hey, in a world running out of water, they're not stupid, these people, right? So they're chomping at the bit and they want these debts gone. So they started turning the water off to anyone who hasn't paid their water bill in just 2 months. Bearing in mind now, they also have huge water bills from the golf courses, from GM, from the stadium, $30 million worth of money that's owed to the water department from delinquent commercial and industrial industries, but they haven't gone after them, right? So they're going in squads, and they've been turning the water off to about 3,000 people a week. And I've known about it because they've been doing this in a much lower number for a number of years now, but nothing as dramatic as what they announced this past spring. I went to Detroit in May, on May 22nd, and we had a huge public meeting, and we met with all of the groups involved. And they said, we can't get any major media in the United States because, well, I said, why? It's because we're black. It's because we're poor and black, and nobody cares. In fact, there's a famous quote from a guy named Patterson, who's the elected CEO. How could you be elected CEO of Oakland County? Said, Detroit's a basket case. We should consider it an Indian reservation and put a wall around it and throw in blankets and corn. That's what he said. Now, what the people say is that Detroit is for sale. There is wealth coming in, buying up all these empty buildings and all these office towers and so on. They want to gentrify Detroit. They want the local people out. And so now they're connecting their unpaid water and electricity bills to their houses, and so they're confiscating their houses. And the local people say, this is all to have us gone, right? So we're sitting around this table, and I say, you know what? We need to bring in the UN. The United States is now a signatory to the UN resolution declaring water to be a human right, water and sanitation. And this is as clear a violation as I have ever seen, even in poorest countries I've ever been in. In fact, the United States gives aid to countries that act like this, right? They said, well, let's do it. So we contacted Katrina Albuquerque, the special rapporteur on water and sanitation, said, would you be interested? She said, you bet. She's kind of a you bet type like I am. And so we documented in great detail what was happening, and we put out a press release, and I put out what I called my fury blog. I was so upset that I just put out this, and suddenly the media was just everywhere. It was just has been unbelievable. We've done television from Russia. Well, you can imagine they love it. I've done the BBC. I was on MSNBC last week. The CBC did a big story. As it happens, has done three stories on it. All of a sudden, we're just everywhere. And it's because we use this process. And had we not had that to go to, we wouldn't have had anything new to do. You can do the boycotts, you can do the protests, you can do whatever, but they tried all that. We've done all the research, everything was out there. We couldn't move them. They were going to turn the water off to 120,000 residences, way more residents, right? Each residence has more than one person by the end of the summer. That's all stopped. Not all, but boy, they're backtracked because we got media from all over the world. And the Special Rapporteur on Water and Sanitation and the Special Rapporteur on Housing and Special Rapporteur on Food all put out a joint statement saying, look, we're going to do a more in-depth report to President Obama, but in the interim, basically at first blush, it looks to us as if the human right to water and sanitation and to housing and to food are being violated in Detroit. So then you get the Tea Partiers putting out these statements. The UN's coming. The UN's bringing troops to Detroit. Katarina is about this high, Katarina and her assistant. I doubt that that's going to make the police in Detroit tremble. So, of course, it's a moral thing. It's not, no troops are coming to Detroit. But it's a very moving story.
That was Maud Barlow speaking in July 2014. As of World Water Day, March 22, 2020, the water system of Detroit is still publicly owned. If you'd like to rehear this program, email wings@wings.org. Wings thanks all our supporters, including your local community radio station, Suzette Cullen, and Genevieve Vaughn, longtime advocate and scholar of the gift economy. The Wings sound logo is from Libana's album A Circle is Cast. Our daily news feed is at facebook.com/wingsradio. I'm Frieda Worden. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.